This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's good when transportation companies get busy. It means trade is picking up. A couple of big shipping companies reported nice profits today. Unfortunately, the global economy seems to be on a slow boat from China. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Yellow Book 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It is the 18th of August today. And the business news of an otherwise slow day in mid-August comes to us from the high seas. The ship has definitely come in for ocean transport companies. The Danish shipping giant Maersk reported a profitable first half of 2010 this morning after a completely horrible 2009. Profits at the big port operator DP World sailed past expectations. Increased global trade, of course, is what's good for them. But demand is so high in some places, it's creating some pretty serious shipping backlogs. Even for us, Marketplace's Scott Tong just moved from Shanghai back to Washington, D.C. He is still waiting for his stuff to show up a month something later. So what to do? Well, bide his time and file a story on the shipping business.
The movers in China took away our beds, bikes, and other stuff 34 days ago. Then our container sat at the port of Shanghai for a month and just now got on a ship. ETA in America, end of September.
That's a great example of what has happened in this shortage of capacity situation.
That's analyst Paul Bingham at IHS Global Insight. When he says shortage of capacity, he means the ships are full and companies are sailing fewer ships as a whole. The turnaround is due in part to American retailers restocking. They kept their shelves bare during the bleak 2009.
When the recovery started to gain hold, there was pent-up demand to bring a tremendous amount of cargo through the freight system.
With all that business, steamship lines raised their prices. Last year, a container like mine cost about $1,200 to move. It's now double that. And the carriers moved the high-priority containers first, not ours.
They do what they call roll cargo, which essentially means they leave a box sitting on the dock for the next ship, which may be a whole nother week or multiple weeks. Your cargo was probably put into that category.
For that, the industry deserves a choppy second half. And seriously, it may get it. Today, Danish shipping giant Maersk said future growth could slow because of uncertainty in the global economy. Here's maritime consultant Ben Hackett.
Consumer spending growth is still relatively low. So May, June, July are very strong months. Don't believe that that will be repeated.
And for all the profits, analysts say shipping lines are also dealing with customers disgruntled by high prices and delays, including this one. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
But he sounds happy, doesn't he? I mean, come on, you got to give him that. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner spent most of yesterday stuck in a big conference in Washington trying to figure out what to do with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The mortgage companies are into the government to the tune of a $150 billion bailout, so they, in turn, are trying to find out how to deal with the countless bad mortgages they hold on their books. One thing they're trying is what are called buybacks, forcing the banks that originally made the loans that went bad to buy them back. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
It's like when you buy, say, a new TV and it doesn't work properly. You take it back to the store and ask for your money back. With buybacks, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have been doing essentially the same thing, but with mortgages that have gone bad. They're taking them to the loan originators and demanding their money back. Greg McBride is a financial analyst at Bankrate.com. He says Fannie and Freddie are in a lot of trouble.
There's a lot of pressure for them to right the ship and become less of a burden on the taxpayers. And part of that means that they're in the process of kicking back any defective merchandise that they own.
A lot of the originators are big names, places like Wells Fargo and Bank of America. But there are plenty of smaller institutions, too. They have been paying up. In the first half of the year, Freddie Mac reportedly managed to recoup about $2.7 billion, but it was still waiting on another $5.6 billion. Last week, Freddie Mac said it would start punishing banks that don't pay up. David Licken works for Mortgage Banking Solutions. It's a consulting firm for the mortgage industry. He says Fannie and Freddie have been playing the tough guy all along.
We're finding that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are very inflexible, and they're saying, sorry, that doesn't work.
Licken says he expects the fights to continue for a while.
Unfortunately, there is an ample supply of loans going bad. So we're anticipating this to become even more of an issue over the next couple of years.
Though probably not indefinitely. New lending requirements are so tight that it should be hard for bad borrowers to get through. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
And now, sadly, some bad news for all the cake batter lickers among you, present company included. Put down the spatula. More than 220 million eggs have been recalled after a salmonella outbreak. And even after the E. coli scares of a couple of years ago, there are still more foods to worry about out there than you might think. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
If eggs had faces, there'd be yolk all over them. But they're far from the only food showing cracks in the food safety system.
There's recalls of food at least once a week.
That's Dr. Michael Hansen, a scientist at Consumer Reports. Here are just a few of the recent food recalls listed on the USDA site. Frozen ground beef products, canned meatball products, chicken nugget products, Firehouse Jerky beef jerky products. Dr. Hansen says the food safety system is broken.
If we look, the number of, for example, of inspections and inspectors have gone down drastically since the early 70s. And the number and the amount of food that's being imported and circulated has only increased.
The Centers for Disease Control has found 76 million cases of foodborne illness every year. The CDC's Dr. Christopher Braden says the government's got to do more.
Inspecting and testing will get you part of the way there, but there have to be whole systems of food safety that have multiple approaches to making food safe.
A lot of those come from food handling, but many come from the food production process. The foods most likely to get you sick? Poultry, meat, and leafy vegetables. Another surprise? Salsa and guacamole. The dip accounts for one in every 25 foodborne illnesses from eating out. Sorry if I spoiled your supper plans. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
The day on Wall Street went down just fine. Thanks very much. Traders squeezed another day of gains out of yesterday's rally. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Once Congress gets back to work after Labor Day, there's going to be a whole lot of back and forth about the Bush tax cuts, whether to extend them or let them expire as scheduled at the end of the year. There were actually two sets of tax cuts, 2001, which affected mostly individual income taxes, and they're what most people think of when they think of the Bush tax cuts. There was another set, though, in 2003, and commentator Glenn Hubbard says we had to extend them as well.
Treasury Secretary Geithner is leading the charge to reduce the 2003 Bush tax cuts. This would increase tax rates on capital gains and could raise the top tax rate on dividends from 15% to nearly 40%. And that would adversely affect stock prices, investment, and the recovery. In fact, low or zero taxes on dividends and capital gains promote saving and investment. More investment means more plant and equipment, and that raises workers' productivity and wages. It's like this. The 2003 tax cut increased the absolute size of workers' share of the economic pie by making the entire pie bigger. These points aren't in dispute. Still, the administration makes two other arguments for raising the taxes. They say the tax increases are necessary to reduce the yawning federal budget deficit, and they also say they're necessary to promote fairness. Now, I agree that deficit reduction is an essential goal, but is it the Treasury's view that raising dividend and capital gains taxes will promote needed growth and revenue? Reducing our present spending binge would seem a better path for growth-promoting deficit reduction. And what about fairness? If the administration wants to place its view of fairness, higher taxes on households earning more than $250,000, ahead of growth and job creation, that's a legitimate political choice. But if fairness is the goal, why not raise more revenue from higher-income taxpayers with less harm to investment and employment? Proposals to limit deductions for such taxpayers would be a clear alternative. We need a serious discussion of tax policy and tax reform to promote growth and fairness. That is the discussion Secretary Geithner should be leading.
Glenn Hubbard is the dean of the Graduate School of Business at Columbia University. Back in the day, he ran the Council of Economic Advisors for President George W. Bush. Back for his regular appearance next week in this space, Robert Reich. Your thoughts are always welcome. Online works best. Our website is marketplace.org. All you got to do is click on that link that says contact. The United Nations says the floods in Pakistan are the worst emergency happening anywhere in the world today. And yet the UN is having trouble collecting on pledges of relief money. They've only gotten about half of the $460 million that's been promised so far. And even the full amount may not be enough to help the millions who've been displaced and rescue the already troubled Pakistani economy. Omar Waresh writes for Time magazine. We reached him in Islamabad. Mr. Waresh, welcome to the program.
Pleasure being here.
As you have been out reporting this story of this flooding in Pakistan, what are you seeing in terms of daily life? How are people getting by?
Over 14 million people have been affected. That means many of them have been rendered homeless. They're being forced to stay in makeshift shelters. There's a scarcity of clean drinking water, which is leading to health problems such as diarrhea. There is very little medical care. People are constantly complaining that they aren't able to get access to relief in time. And beyond all of this, of course, you have food shortages, prices rising, just miserable circumstances throughout the country.
Pakistan's economy was heavily agricultural to begin with. What I imagine it's just been all but destroyed, the agricultural economy and how people make so much of their living there.
Yes, I mean, agriculture in Pakistan accounts for 25% of the economy at least. Nearly half of the population actually works in the agricultural sector. Many more depend on the agricultural sector indirectly. Its main crops, cotton, which is a major exporting crop for Pakistan, has been devastated. The wheat, people had been hoping this year that they'd be able to benefit from a wheat surplus exported. And as you may know, since Russia has put a ban on its own exports, the price has risen. And Pakistan saw that as an economic opportunity. Now the focus will have to be on feeding its own people. So there are acres and acres. People are talking about 25 million acres of land that have been devastated.
Once the waters recede, though, there will be talk of rebuilding. How much of the infrastructure do you think remains? I mean, bridges, roads, they've been washed out.
In a number of cases, yes, especially in the northwest frontier province. For example, all the bridges there along the River Indus have been destroyed. Schools will have to be rebuilt. Dams will have to be repaired to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. Roads have meant that some people are still stranded and haven't been able to make their way back. So there's huge infrastructural damage, which Pakistan's finance minister has estimated to be in the region of billions of dollars.
There's a macroeconomic question here as well, right? I mean, Pakistan is dependent on IMF loans. It's in not good condition. It was in not good condition even before all of this happened.
No. In fact, before the floods, Pakistan's economy was in a miserable state. So as you mentioned, it was dependent on an $11.3 billion support package from the IMF. Pakistan was already struggling to meet the conditions for that support package. The idea was after that support package, it would actually take out another support package from the IMF. At the moment, before the floods, its national debt stood at $55.5 billion. Much of the national budget is devoted to two things, maintaining the military and debt servicing. Now, just yesterday, they took out a $900 million loan from the World Bank. And today there's a special loan that's been announced from the Asian Development Bank. This is very expensive borrowing that Pakistan really can't afford. But since there's been very little funds coming in from donors, only about $250 million have arrived so far, the Pakistan government has no other choice.
Omar Waresh in Islamabad, Pakistan, talking about the floods there. He reports out of Islamabad for Time magazine. Mr. Waresh, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, this is only going to hurt a little bit.
To me, it was so obvious that it was going to be the future of colon screening.
The business of prevention. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose roughly a tenth of 1% today, about 9 points, closed to 10,415. The NASDAQ nudged up a 0.25%, 6 points, ended at 2215. The S&P 500 snuck up nearly 0.2%. That's a point. Finished at 1,094. Target announced good second quarter earnings today thanks to some heavy cost cutting. The retailer stock jumped 2.5%, pulled a lot of retailers along with it. Nordstrom racked up a 2% gain, and Taylor zipped up more than 6% today. Energy companies took a beating as oil prices fell. EOG Resources sputtered nearly 2%. Console Energy spilled 2.75% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.63%, still pretty low. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRowePrice.com. By Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. A House Subcommittee on Energy and Environment discusses the safety of seafood from the Gulf. And events mark National Aviation Day at the Wright Brothers National Memorial in North Carolina. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Like I just said, this is public radio, so it's not like we have a ton of money to throw around. More profit-oriented media companies do tend to have some extra cash, though, and how one in particular has been spending it is making news. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, owner of Fox News and The Wall Street Journal, has given the Republican Governors Association $1 million. The money was actually donated back in June. News Corp says it supports Republicans' pro-business agenda and that the donation is not going to affect its news coverage one tiny little bit. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more.
The idea of a news organization giving money to a political party might sound shocking, but it's old news, says Dave Leventhal with the Center for Responsive Politics.
Ultimately, when you look at CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News, to some degree, they have all done this.
General Electric, owner of NBC, ABC's parent company Disney, and Viacom, which owns CBS, have all given thousands of dollars to political parties this year. But none of those donations made headlines. Ken Doctor is the author of Newsonomics. He says this is no ordinary donation.
It's the size of the gift. And then I think it's the size of Fox News in the political news landscape.
Doctor says Fox News has the biggest audience of any news show, It's also perceived to lack a firewall between News Corp's business interests and Fox's news coverage. Political satirist Stephen Colbert characterized the relationship this way.
The sizzling will they or won't they flirt fest between Fox News and the Republican Party. They've always played it so coy, you know.
Colbert's take on the $1 million donation?
They put a ring on it!
But why would News Corp give that ring to the Republican Governors Association? Why not to congressmen or the national party? Influence, says Larry Sabato. He directs the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia.
There have never been 37 gubernatorial elections in one November. And you have a massive number of open seats, which means that a majority of the governors will be freshmen.
And when there's no incumbent, money can have a bigger impact on an election. Sabato says the Governors Association is also enormously influential in Washington and not too shabby when it comes to producing presidential candidates. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
A lot of what was in the health care reform law is going to roll out over time. This coming January, there's going to be a biggie. After New Year's, your health insurance company is going to have to pick up the entire tab when you go for certain screening tests. No patient copays at all. Preventive screening in this country has always been a mix of science and big business, the cost-benefit life-death analysis of doing a given test versus not doing it. That's a dilemma neatly summed up by the story of one of the most frequently done tests out there, the humble colonoscopy. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Gregory Warner reports.
If you're over 50 years old, your doctor has probably told you to get screened for colorectal cancer and that the best test is a colonoscopy. The story of how colonoscopy became one of the most common medical procedures in the country begins with a fiery editorial in a gastroenterology journal. Its writer, a young oncologist named Alfred Nugent. The year was 1988.
To me, it was so obvious that it was going to be the future of colon screening.
Though he never quite imagined how fast it would catch on.
That 50% of the American public allows themselves to have a tube that's 4 feet long inserted up their backside is, to me, absolutely incredible.
Why?
Why?
Back in the 80s, when Nugent was writing his editorial, doctors were using a shorter tube. It's a simpler test called a sigmoidoscopy. It looks at only half the colon. In that test, there's no sedation, no day off from work, no jug of laxatives the night before, and maybe no gastroenterologist. Your primary care doctor could probably do the procedure himself. So why'd we trade up from the simpler test to the more specialized one?
The thought was, well, if looking at part of the colon is good, looking at the entire colon must be better.
Deborah Fisher is a gastroenterologist at the VA Medical Center in Durham, North Carolina. She says there has never been any hard evidence, no clinical trial, showing that colonoscopy screening saved more lives.
And it wasn't always acknowledged that doing one test versus the other test also increased the cost and the risk.
Colonoscopy is 3 to 4 times more expensive than the simpler sigmoidoscopy test, and the risk of complication is 7 times higher. Still, the idea caught on, and as it did, it transformed the profession of gastroenterology. We went from too many specialists to a national shortage.
If I just wanted to do that, I could. Just screen colonoscopies all day.
Maurice Leonard is a gastroenterologist I meet in Lumberton, New Jersey. His group practice has grown on colonoscopy's rising tide.
We started in 1990.
2 years after Nugent's editorial.
With one room the size of a bathroom.
Then in 2000, Katie Couric had her colonoscopy on national TV, causing a 20% spike in screenings. The next year, Congress ordered Medicare to cover the procedure, private insurers followed suit, and Dr. Leonard took over 2 floors.
A good number of the people we see every day are otherwise healthy people who are here because they're screening colonoscopy, and the expansion has really been driven by that.
In 2008, the American Cancer Society took an extra step. It christened colonoscopy the gold standard of screening. Dr. Leonard took over a whole new building.
The new expand room? This is one of them, yes.
Now he's expanding again. The new healthcare law will compel insurance companies to pay, in full, for colorectal cancer screening. Right now, a patient's out-of-pocket costs can range up to $1,000 or more. There'll be a bump.
Yeah, I think that'll be an increase in number of procedures when the barrier of deductibles and copays decreases.
No one knows exactly how big a business colonoscopy screening has become. Some 37 million Americans over the age of 50 have had one, and yet the first good study of its effectiveness only came out last year, a large study out of Ontario. It found that colonoscopy did not do better than that older, cheaper test, the sigmoidoscopy, to reduce cancer deaths in the more hard-to-reach half of the colon. In other words, if looking at part of the colon is good, looking at the whole colon may not be any better. Again, here's Deborah Fisher.
The first reaction from a lot of gastroenterologists was just, well, they clearly don't know what they're doing. You know, who the heck is doing colonoscopy in Canada? What are they thinking? But now there's several studies, and they're all telling the same stories.
And that's the point. There are only three studies, and all three of them have exactly the same finding.
This summer, Al Neugut wrote a new editorial in the Journal of the American Medical Association. He said his thoughts had changed.
If today we were where we were in 1988, I would not institute colonoscopy based on the current evidence.
As Neugut has discovered, it's easier to start a revolution than stop one.
It's hard to slow the train down when it's running. You've got to have a pretty clear reason before you switch tracks.
Dr. Doug Rex is one of the world's experts in colonoscopy technique. He's done over 30,000 of them himself. He says that these new studies are a wake-up call.
But I don't think we've seen enough evidence yet that means that we have to all of a sudden slam on the brakes.
And nobody is yet. On the contrary, the American Cancer Society is lobbying the White House to adopt its guidelines, making colonoscopy the gold standard.
We stand very strongly behind our guidelines.
Stephen Finan is senior policy director.
Colonoscopy is one of the tests that we really should be pushing very hard to increase.
Al Neugut hopes that this scientific debate will resolve in the next year or two as more evidence emerges. But science does not progress in a vacuum.
So that becomes now a political issue, and is an insurance company not going to pay for it?
Because in the science of preventive medicine, there's more than just science. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
If you and your doctor are pondering a screening test for you, you can head on over to our website to check the list of which screenings are going to be covered come January. Our homepage is marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/large-cap-equity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out this afternoon, and I quote from a filing today at the SEC, Form S-1, it says, a registration statement under the Securities Act of 1933. It's an IPO filing for a hot new company you might have heard of. General Motors made it official today. They're going public. Shares will be listed on the New York Stock Exchange and in Toronto, ticker symbol GM, appropriately enough. No specific price or dollar amounts for how much the company actually expects to raise. Could be something near $20 billion. Also, no comment from the White House about taxpayers' 61% share of that company. Timeline for the actual sale of those shares is still TBD. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 9 points. That's about a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ up 6 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 snuck up 1 point. That is nearly 0.2%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this program, figuring out how to compensate for really big oil spills.
$31 per U.S. household, or almost $3 billion in total.
I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.